You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we are ascending up a large hill high above the City of Angels in the Angeles National Forest. Angelinos, you know, live in a huge, sprawling, urban megalopolis. And it's easy to forget that we're surrounded by all this beautiful nature, like up here in the mountains. Once upon a time, of course, this whole area was in a state of nature, back way before settlers came and paved over the LA Basin. Native American tribes lived here, foraging, hunting, and living in harmony with the land. Some local Native people are carrying on these ancient traditions. One of them is Heidi Lucero. She's the tribal chair of the Juaneño Band of Mission Indians from the Ahashiman Nation, and she joins us right now. And Leela Higgins, frequent guest on our program, senior manager for community science over at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, has come along for the ride as well, and we're all up here looking at acorns. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hello, me, you.
Okay. Heidi, you're going to teach us about foraging for acorns, right? Tell us a little bit about the significance of this little nut in the traditional diet of Native Americans who are local to this area.
So whether it's this traditional area in Southern California or Central or Northern California, the acorn is one of the staple foods of California Indians. We used to eat it in kind of like a mush similar to cream of wheat or malto meal, and it would be served hot with every meal.
So it's milled?
Yes.
Essentially, you mill it like flour or some
kind
of...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Grind it.
You grind it. Well, Heidi, all right, so let's talk about the different kind of oaks. What kind of oak trees do you tend to find up here in the San Gabriel Mountains? And these are obviously the kinds of oaks that you get the acorns from.
Right. We have the canyon oak, the valley oak, the interior live oak, and we also have the black oak. And occasionally, I haven't found one here, but I know up a little further north, we do have the tan oak.
The tan oak. So does it matter to you what kind of acorns you find? What kind of oak trees are up here depositing those acorns onto the ground?
Well, I'll gather any type of acorn and try and eat it, which they're all edible. But I do have my favorites. The black acorn is my very favorite. It's the nuttiest. It's creamy. It's got a lot of fat in it. So it's got that nice creamy consistency.
You say creamy. This is creamy before you mill it. This is right out of the gate. You crack it open and what's inside you eat.
No.
No. All
you
right.
Can't eat it like that.
You cannot eat it like
not
that.
Not unless you want a bellyache.
Okay. Why the bellyache?
So acorns have tannic acid in them. So after you gather them, you have to roast them. And you want to roast them because you don't want your acorn weevils to be eating all of your acorns because they're little bugs that are in there and they're very bitter from eating the acorn.
So you're roasting them to kill the weevils.
You're roasting them to kill the ones that have weevils in them and then you're so that they don't get into the good ones.
Gotcha.
So and then you have to crack them open and then you grind them. And when I say creamy, it's the actual wee wish, which is what we call it in my language. Is the soup that we eat, and that's the creamy part. Once you know, those fats are released when you cook them, that's where it gets really creamy.
So how do you get rid of the tannic acid then so your belly doesn't hurt?
So what you would do is after you grind the acorns, then you would go through a leaching process and where you would use water to leach the tannic acid out. So typically you would find your acorn processing station where they were cracking and grinding acorns near a water source or a watershed where they could then take that acorn flour and leach it in the creek or the river.
It seems like this is such a huge process for, I mean, you're not getting a whole lot of food out of it, are you?
Yeah, it's high in protein and high in fat. So it is definitely an arduous process, but when you have something that can last through the winter season, when you don't have to hunt, it really is worth having that as a food source. It's something that can be stored, and it's definitely worth the process of making the acorn soup or the wee wish.
How far back does acorn gathering and making, you know, milling the acorns and the process by which you guys do that, how far back does it go?
Time immemorial. It's one of our staple foods from the beginning of time. It's part of our creation story as well.
This is all tribes of Native Americans.
Well, at least my tribe and the Southern California tribes, we all have come from a very similar creation story that was from the village of Pavungna. And it talks about the acorn. That was one of the gifts that was given to us as food, was the acorn. So from time immemorial, this has been our food.
All right, so we jaunted all the way up here. Shall we go foraging?
Sure.
Let's do it.
Well, I found one with a little hole in it, so weevil.
That's alert. A weevil. All right, that's a weevil. I see a lot of leaves, dried leaves. I see a lot of rocks and pebbles. A lot of dirt, sticks. But not a whole lot of acorns.
Mm-mm.
There's an open one, but he's an old one, right?
Yep.
Here's an, oh, wait, no, that's an acorn cap, right? Isn't that what you call it, the cap of it?
That's the acorn, this is the cap.
That's the cap right there. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So no good, right?
Nope, can't eat the caps.
Okay, more rocks. Oh, there's another cap. Oh, wait, nope, that one's broken. Heidi, there's this bluff that we're looking at that's above us, and this canopy of beautiful oak trees that are above us. Why are we not seeing any acorns?
There's several reasons. One is climate change. Two is the severe drought here in California.
Which is attributed to climate change.
Yes. And the other thing is there was a fire here.
Which is attributed to climate change.
Yes. So, definitely those are the issues and why we're not seeing as many acorns as we normally are.
How many acorns would you normally see here?
Well, there was three of us when we came last time, and we gathered probably three or four big boxes full. And this year, I'm not seeing any. So it's a huge difference.
Heidi, tell us a little bit about your tribe. This is the Juaneño Band of Ahashiman, right?
The Juaneño Band of Mission Indians, Ahashiman Nation.
The Ahashiman Nation.
Mm-hmm. And we are the Aboriginal tribe of Orange County. Our northernmost village is at Cal State Long Beach, Pavungna. And our southernmost village is Las Flores. My ancestors were the builders of the Mission San Juan Capistrano.
Oh, wow.
And we have our tribal office in the city of San Juan Capistrano as well.
We're a long way from Orange County right
yes.
now, aren't we?
Yeah. So this is actually Tongva and Tataviam area. But I have had been given permission to gather here.
Do they gather here too?
They do.
They do.
Yeah. This is their cultural center. Haramakna is their cultural center.
Did you learn this from your family?
I didn't. I learned how to make and gather acorns as an adult.
So your parents didn't, they weren't like, they didn't teach you how to...
No, not my mom,
acorns.
Not my grandma, no.
Did they know how to do that?
No.
No.
My grandma might have, but she never did. She never showed me, but definitely not my mother.
Okay, definitely not your mother, but now that you're doing the acorns, unlike the rest of your family... Do they eat what you're putting together?
No, they won't eat it.
They won't eat it.
They don't like it. They've tried it made by somebody else and they didn't like it. And so they were absolutely not even trying it. So, but that's okay. More acorn for me.
What about your tribe? I mean, do we see a lot of people in your tribe who do the same thing? Who?
No, there's only probably a handful of us that actually know how to process acorn or that actually eat it on a regular basis.
But they know the history too, right?
Some of them, not
really?
All of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us the status of your tribe.
So we have about 15 hundred members, and then we have adult members, and then we have a few hundred children, and we are state recognized and in the process of becoming federally recognized. It's quite a long process. We've been in the process for over 35 years.
Oh, wow. How much longer?
Well, we are building a stronger petition than we did before. So we aren't even going to submit for several years until we have a very strong petition, because this is our last chance.
Through the magic of radio, we're on the back bed of your... Is this a Chevy?
Ford
F-150?
350. 350 diesel.
You can fit a lot of acorns on the back bed of this truck. My God. So we've got a nice Coleman portable stove here, and you've got a lovely light blue pot, and we are stirring. What are we stirring?
This is our acorn. So it's the acorn flour that's already been leached with water, and we're just going to cook it, and it's going to start to thicken up, and then you're going to get to taste it.
Okay. So the tannic acid has already been removed.
Yes.
So no bellyache here.
No bellyache there.
Okay. And this looks to me, it looks like a darker version of like a cream of wheat or something. Mm-hmm. Cream of rice.
Yep.
Okay. Where's the butter? I think I missed the butter.
Yeah, no butter.
No butter.
Okay. Sometimes like to put salt in there, some like honey. Just depends on where you're at. Look at this.
It's thickening up so fast. Mm-hmm. And this on a cold winter's day, right during the holidays.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe add a little cinnamon to it? No. All right.
Let's see.
All right. To be quite honest, it tastes like I thought it would taste, right? Like flavor, nutty flavor, mm-hmm. right? But nothing overpowering. I like the texture of it.
A lot of times you would eat it with your rabbit meat, your deer meat, your fish, and it's just acorn flour and water.
Heidi Lucero, tribal chair of the Juneno Band of Mission Indians from the Haxhaman Nation. Heidi, thanks for showing us around. What an exciting day.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm always willing to teach people how to make and eat traditional foods.
Leela Higgins, of course, our friend, senior manager for community science at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. Leela, thanks for coming along with us.
Thanks, and it was an honor to be out here with Heidi.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, you heard Heidi mention that her tribe is working to gain federal recognition, and it is a lengthy, as in a decades-long process. And despite all the effort it takes, it doesn't always end in success. There are, for example, no federally recognized tribes in L.A., Ventura, or Orange counties. But having a tribe, whether or not it's recognized by the federal government, is one thing. Feeling like you belong to a tribe, feeling secure in your identity as a Native American, well, that can bring up a lot of questions, particularly for Native youth growing up in the city. Joining us now is Rudy Ortega Jr. He is the tribal president of the Fernandinho Tatavium Band of Mission Indians. Their tribal area runs from the San Fernando Valley up to the Kern County border. Rudy, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me on here. It's a pleasure.
We heard briefly from Heidi Lucero how tough it is for a tribe to be federally recognized and how difficult it's been a process. What makes it so tough, and why does it take such a long time?
Well, you know, the process that takes a long time is the merits and documentation and pretty much gathering all your historical records and information, genealogy documentation, tribal history, tribal community, because that's what the federal government's looking for, is not an individual that has ancestry to a Native American, but rather has that community stayed as the tribal community. And that's the important aspects. And where did those documents exist, right? Because a lot of history that we see comes in California, it comes from mission records, then into Mexican era of certain land grants, and then also into California era, where pretty much the first laws in California was essentially exterminating Indians and moving Indians off of their ancestral lands so that folks can occupy those lands that were settlers coming in. So that's what makes it difficult. It's pretty much telling that story and with documents and evidence to pretty much explain your case as a tribe. And so it takes many years to gather and research for my tribe. We've done it for about 2 decades of research and documentation. And that's where it's time consuming and also an expense as well to the tribe.
Right. Time consuming. It's expensive. And there's a reason why you try and keep going, right, to get it done, because that recognition does a lot, doesn't it?
It does. It does a lot and keeps going. And one of the key thing for tribes, even myself, my tribe was a non-federal tribe pursuing federal acknowledgement, is that existence. You know, how do you financially sustain your tribal government? And that's the importance. So gaining recognition changes that, where you can legally and actually open an account for your own tribal government and to bring commerce to your tribal government, to create jobs, to bring resources, bring programming, and have a path to health programs and even education programs. But as a state or non-federally recognized tribe, we don't have those. And so we have to think of alternative and creative ways to sustain ourselves. And in my tribe, we've done so. We created nonprofits and for-profit business to sustain and continue operating as a tribal government.
How many members does your tribe have? This is the Fernandinho, right?
That's correct. The Fernandinho, Tatavia, and Banamishan Indians. There's 860 people registered as tribal citizens with the tribe that they have to provide documentation, genealogy, and tracing all the way back to Mission San Fernando as a baptismal record, alongside that those people descend from a village within that territory of San Fernando Valley, always the Kern County, that they came from an Indian village within that region, and that we're taking the Mission San Fernando and baptized. That's how we register those individuals that are registered within our tribe today.
I mean, there is this sense, Rudy, of belonging, right? And we all have that, whether we're Native American, or whether it goes to European ancestry or wherever, Asian ancestry, African, throughout the world, we want to belong to something. Is that what's at heart of what's going on here? I mean, do you see a lot of people trying to get in touch or trying to be a part of this tribe because they want to belong to something? They want that ancestry to be acknowledged.
Most definitely. I mean, there's a lot of people that are registered, always been around and know of their ancestry and blood because they're in the community. But what we've seen in the number of years is those folks, unfortunate events to them, they were probably adopted out as a child or, you know, just moved away because the family moved away because of jobs. And they want that reconnection. And when they discover they have this ancestry blood to our tribe here, it just brings them joy and excitement to read their history and then read the genealogy documentation to know who their grandparents or great-great-grandparents. And the fact that it goes all the way back to an Indian village really excites those people. And that's that sense of belonging that those folks crave and earn for. And like I said, you know, the ones that were pretty much adopted away as a child, no fault to them. And they later come back and always lived in the Santa Clarita Valley or San Fernando Valley. And they reach out to us and they said, hey, I did my genealogy and I found out my parents or my father or mother was registered with your tribe. And I want to pursue acknowledgement and enrollment within the tribe and understand their world, because it's like a whole new door open for them, a whole new window open for them that they did not know of because they were adopted out.
There's a book called They're There. The author is Tommy Orange, who's a member of the Cheyenne and the Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. Tommy grew up in Oakland, and I know in the novel, he tells the story of a teenager living with his great aunt. When she's not around, he secretly dresses up in regalia that she has hidden away in her bedroom. And then he looks at himself in the mirror and dances. He dances these native dances that he learns on YouTube. And, you know, I wonder, I mean, does this sound familiar to you, this difficulty that some young Native Americans have connecting with their heritage, you know, because we live in a modern society with all the accoutrement that goes along with it, right?
Most definitely. And we see that in this huge metropolitan area of Los Angeles, right? Because, you know, you're competing against, you know, regular soccer, baseball, all these other sports things. And even, you know, what has been modernized as karate, different stuff that just become in the films that you see on regular TV. So when you discover this heritage that you have and you know, you get both ends. You get you get ridiculed, joked about. If you say you're Native American, they're like, well, you don't look like the ones from the TV. You don't have that long hair if you have short hair, or you don't dress in feathers or regalia all the time, because that's only at certain points in time. But when you do have it and you have that pride, and you go on today, they go on YouTube, social media, and there's these pages that they can reconnect themselves, you know, from miles apart and learn and understand their heritage and culture and learn these traditional songs and these dances. And that's what sparks these pride. And these children, have gravitated towards it. And that's what we've seen in some of the programs our nonprofit has, Baku. They have these youth enrichment programs that reconnect those different tribal backgrounds and teach them how to reconnect to those communities of theirs as well.
Did you ever experience those kinds of identity questions when you were growing up?
You know, for me, I had the privilege. My father was tribal leader for 5 decades. My father did have those challenging things because when he grew up, he was born in 1926. And the time he was growing up, you couldn't say publicly you're Native. You couldn't do anything that you were tribal or Native American out in the public area. They was banned and it was frowned upon. You couldn't even speak a different language other than English. And so he really had to suppress his identity in that fashion. When he became an adult and came back from World War II, he felt the change and he said, you know what, his children was not going to go through what he's done. So fortunately, I had the pride of my father always saying, be proud of who you are and go out there. You may be laughed at or joked about, but you're Native American, you're Fernandino Indian, you're Fernandino Tatavian. Just be proud of who you are. So I always had that. I always had a sense of who I was, my heritage, from both sides. You know, my mother's Mexican indigenous from Mexico, and I have pride of that ancestry as well. But I've heard about it from many different other tribal families in my tribe who always felt that they really couldn't expose or express. And so that's what the tribe does today, to make sure that they have that comfortable space to come together. And we host different tribal ceremonies today in public spaces so they can come and sing songs with us, and we're teaching them their language and teaching them the songs today so they can have that connection.
Do you have children?
I do. I have 4 children from the ages of 13 all the way to 25 years old and with 1 grandchild.
Is that something you think about for them and for future generations?
Oh, I do. You know, we have annually our winter social gathering, which is our Christmas party. And I always had my children volunteer and also participate so they can know how to give to the community and as well be engaged in the community. So, you know, that's one of the things that we've always talked to them about is that their heritage and culture. In fact, our children are in traditional names. Like my son's name is Tomiar, which means chief in our language, and Noli, that means education, wisdom in our language. Down to my granddaughter, her name is Menash, which means, you know, honey girl. And many of our tribal people are doing the same. They're choosing our native languages again to name their children. And that's a big step because we know when we first named them, again, that goes back to people saying, what kind of name is that? My son always get talked about, is that a Middle Eastern name? But no, it's a name from here, from Los Angeles, traditional language, before any Spanish or English language came into the States.
I know that Native Americans, Rudy, have struggled with a lot of, you know, pretty difficult and troubling issues. How do you see the future for Native people in America? Do you see signs of improvement? Do you see reasons of optimism going forward?
I do. It's like a roller coaster, and it ties and links into the tribes petitioning for federal acknowledgement. Today, what I've seen is this land acknowledgement where many huge corporations, even down to the Oscars, they made a land acknowledgement early in the year to acknowledge the 3 regional tribes of Los Angeles County, Venturino Chumash, Gabrielino Tongva, and my tribe, Fernandino Tatavium. And it's a step. It's a step to, you know, acknowledging the land that all this is on today and acknowledging the First Peoples. And I see that going forward a bit more, but, you know, we got to keep the momentum going and really start from within our own communities to be prideful, to be connected. But, you know, I, like I said, I see it coming up right now. I see more and more folks are interested in Native American cultures and tribes and history to really share that space and acknowledge those peoples and those tribes, especially that have been here from time immemorial.
Rudy Ortega Jr., tribal president of the Fernandinho Tatavian Band of Mission Indians. Thank you, Rudy, for your time. We appreciate it. Happy holidays to you.
Same to you. Thank you very much for having me on.
That'll do it for us on this episode of Greater LA. We're taking a little Christmas break through the rest of this week. Tomorrow, a story from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Local journalist Molly Page finds a mentor in a prominent local female surfer and discovers there's far more to surf culture than she'd seen from the shore. That's tomorrow in Place of Us here on KCRW. We are online, by the way, the whole Greater LA team at kcrw.com/GLA. Subscribe to the podcast while you're there and get every episode of Greater LA delivered fresh to your feed. Share your thoughts with us, too. Tell us about something you want to hear on our show, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. And by the way, GLA is Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Amy Toff, Phil Richards, and Christian Bordahl. And Steve Chitakis, thanks for your ears and time. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you.